Hey guys, I just want to start off by saying thank you for listening to the podcast. But I can't stress enough how important it is for me to continue on producing content, for you to go on and leave us a review on iTunes or the Podbean app. Your questions and comments help me keep this thing going, and It's really important for the podcast. The more reviews we get and the higher up in the ranking I go, the more people I could reach. It's really important for you to do so. If you really like the podcast, we'd like to hear from you, and we would really, really appreciate the feedback and reviews. Also want to take a little bit of time here real quick to thank Phoenix Shooting Bags for their continued support of the podcast. And if you want to up your shooting game, go check them out, phoenixshootingbags.com. You can use promo code John Stallone, all one word, and purchase bags for 20% off. So check them out. This, honestly, it's a game changer, and you won't be disappointed. So phoenixshootingbags.com. Let's roll into the next episode. Today we are going to talk to the Elk Singer himself, Tony Windrup, and we're going to talk a little bit about Hunting Rosies, a little bit about bugling. Want to hear a story about his number one, I think.
Yes, sir. Okay.
Yeah, in Washington. What's going on, Tony?
Not much, man. Looking forward to having a show with you. This is great. Appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been having some technical difficulties already this morning, so I hope that the audio on this comes out right, because I am working out of my home. You probably hear tile noises in the background. We're remodeling my house, and Tony's having some connection issues over there, so hopefully this won't be a bust here, and everybody will be able to hear it. So anyway, why don't you give us a little rundown about yourself and what you do?
All right. Well, I'm 44 years old, live on the Washington coast. My main job, I'm a equipment operator, a road maintenance technician for Lewis County Public Works. And then I do my music on the side, which has kind of moved me a little bit further into the hunting world with hunting itself. So I spent a lot of time hunting, father two, and wife and one stepson. And yeah, just I love the Pacific Northwest. It's a good place to live. Everything's right out the back door. Literally fishing 5 minutes from the house, or hunting elk 10 minutes from the house.
Nice. Everything's really good except for the Wi-Fi out there.
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding.
I was just messing with you. It's funny because I had my buddy Charles on, and he lives in like just outside of San Francisco. I mean, come on. It's California. In San Francisco, one of the largest cities in the United States. And he always has issues with his service. And it's like, I can never get a really clean
Yeah.
podcast with them. It just drives me. It's funny, guy. I was teasing him because, like, I was on the line with Remy Warren, and he was like in Alaska, and he sounded perfect in the sticks, you know. So, but anyhow,
we're right at the foothills of the Willapa Hills, and probably 10 minutes out of the main town here. So the Wi-Fi out here isn't the great. Neither is the cell service, but you take what you can get here.
Yeah. So anyway, we'll make the best of it, and hopefully everybody will be able to hear it.
Okay.
So I got some questions for you. You know, being in Washington, obviously you get the opportunity, and being on the coast, you get to hunt Rosies, but you've also hunted Rockies as well. Yeah. What would you say are the main behavioral differences between the two?
Well, definitely the size is the first thing right out of the gate for me. Mm-hmm. these Roosevelt bodies are giants. Now, I have taken a couple of Rockies that have been big bodied as well, but these things are giants. There's no doubt about it. I mean, I think that one big one I killed was probably somewhere around 1,000 pounds. Mm. You know, but the terrain's different, food's different. These Roosevelts are stubborn as hell sometimes calling, where the Rocky Mountain bulls, obviously they're probably stubborn at sometimes too, but for some reason I've had really good luck calling in Rocky Mountain elk. Mm-hmm. A little bit easier than calling these Rosies. And that could be the terrain too, making it a little bit easier for them to come in quicker in that more open country, or maybe stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, and definitely another difference is the antler size, for sure. And you could have 3.5-year-old bulls that are Rocky Mountain bulls in the, you know, pushing 300. And around here, it takes a bull probably 5-6 years to get that big, Roosevelts.
Gotcha. I kind of like lost my place here for a second, guys. It's what happens when you got so much commotion. As I mentioned before, I'm remodeling my house and there's guys slamming things in the back. It just kind of threw me off over here. I don't know if you can hear all that crap going on back there, but so anyway, I was going to ask you, what are some of the things that you do to stack the odds in your favor when you're hunting Rosies specifically? Like, what are some of your tactics? What are you looking for? Kind of take me through that.
Well, number one for me and my brother and the guys that I hunt with, we scout a lot. I mean, we're in the woods basically, you know, bear hunting in August, and we're actually scouting for elk the whole time, which is the number one thing, I think. I mean, you can figure out where those herds are, and wherever those herds are and all the cows are, there's going to be bulls there, you know, come September 1st. And we usually open up bow season around somewhere between the 1st and the 10th in Washington every year. So,
right.
That's one thing, but we shoot a lot, get in shape, do a lot of shed hunting.
Yeah.
Everything that, you know, those are things that stack the odds for us as far as, you know, knowing where the elk are, what bulls made it every year. Mm-hmm. And just being in shape to do it. So,
Do you see them doing any kind of migration from where they're running, you know, summer range versus winter range?
You know, this country around here is more rolling foothills. I think the highest peak that we got here on the coast is maybe 2,500 feet. Oh, and wow. And then in the Olympics, you know, as you know, up the peninsula there.
Yep.
I think they get into the 3,500s. Don't quote me on that, but I think that's could be potential right now. Those elk will definitely migrate out of that ground because it gets so much snow and nasty weather. But around here, basically they'll just, you know, move a mile or two is about it down into the farm fields. And that's about it for here.
Gotcha. So it's pretty safe to say that, you know, when you're shed hunting, you know, you can probably find elk where you're finding sheds in the early season. So it's like,
yes, okay. You can actually find sheds right where you're elk hunting, you know, mm-hmm. versus going, you know, Idaho or Montana or mm-hmm. Oregon and being in the mountains. Typically there's too much snow there for them to shed. And then you'll actually be hunting them in September where, where they weren't
right
during the winter.
And do you find that they typically hang close to the cow groups in the early season, even though they're bachelored up, or are they completely separate?
During the early season of bow season, when it first
starts? Before bow season starts, like while you're doing your scouting.
Yeah, so in August, they're still bachelored up pretty good, especially, you know, that first little bit of August, And then right towards the end of it, everybody starts moving off and rubbing their velvet off and getting ready to put on a show. But as far as, and even in July, you know, we'll scout a little bit in July and same thing. Yeah. You'll see bachelor bulls, anywhere from 5 to 10 here on the coast, which is nothing really compared to a giant herd of Rocky Mountain bulls that bachelor up.
Right.
But they move around quite a bit too, as you know, and every other elk hunter knows that, they might be into velvet and you might see them one spot and that first week of August and 3 to 4 weeks later, they're 4 or 5, 6 miles away in another drainage where they like to rut.
Right. Right. So let me ask you this, because it's so thick and I'm assuming you're not able to glass and stuff, how are you scouting them? Are you just walking around and looking for them, or what are you doing to scout?
You know, a lot of the elk that we hunt, we know so well, we'll just find their trails. We'll hike trails. We do a lot of trail cameras.
Okay.
That's one of the, I mean, that's the best way to do your scouting for you in some of that thick country that doesn't have clear cuts. I mean, a lot of this country, they stopped clear cutting years ago with the spotted owl issue. And, you know, they just put to, basically, they just do a little commercial thing here and there now, but it's so much easier for those elk to hide that they stop logging now. It's a lot harder to find them unless you're hunting the timber company ground, you know, which Weyerhaeuser owns and Rainier and some different timber companies. There's actually a lot more clear cuts and they're still logging to where the elk aren't as hard to find.
Right.
You know, and that being said, it's typically all summer or, you know, late spring, because the rest of the time they're being hunted by archery, muzzleloader, and rifle hunters as well. So they don't get much of a break around here for about 3 months.
Yeah, yeah. Do you do any hunting for them in the late seasons, or do you just typically hunt them during the rut?
Well, we've been fortunate enough to do pretty good during the early seasons around here for the last 20 years. And there was only, I can think of 1 year that I ended up hunting the late season, and it's open for cows. Well, it used to be. Now there's spotty units that are still open for a cow and some aren't, but that's where it gets a lot more difficult, because it's typically in I think the 1st of December. And like I said, they've been chased for forever. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot harder. But so going to tactics for late season is basically, you know, getting in these big walk-ins and going as far as you can away from somebody else and trying to glass for them. But if there was no clear cuts in that country, you're solely on knowledge of where those elk trails are that you've found in the past.
Right.
And that's basically the only way you can do it, or trail cameras, and, you know, check your trail cameras every few days and try and figure out how far that they've gone.
So, right. Okay. So I can't imagine that you can pattern them on water or anything, since there's water everywhere.
Right.
Yeah. That just seems like a really difficult hill to climb, to hunt them like that there.
Yeah.
At least where I hunted anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, and then let alone just to try and be able to shoot through that stuff with a bow and arrow. Mm-hmm. You know, they're constantly in that heavy cover during the later season, especially.
Right. So talk to me about calling. What are you looking to do? Like, how are you calling them in? Are you utilizing bugle? Are you doing cow calls, combination, breeding cycles, or breeding sequences? What's your tactic?
You know, I do a little bit of everything. We had just, it's kind of funny. We had just put out our video last week of my hunt last year, and it really shows a lot about what we do. We started bugling just to try and get an answer in some really big country, obviously.
Okay.
So location for me is number one. I mean, I'm going to go in there and bugle into these big canyons and see if anything answers. And most of the time, you know, they don't answer.
Are you using a standard location bugle, or are you Challenger right off the bat, or what are you doing?
It's a standard location bugle, and I call it the lazy man bugle, and I don't chuckle with it. I just, you know, I've heard elk talk to each other so many different times where they're just basically letting each other know where they're at. I mean, if you get in an area with a high concentration of elk, you'll be on one ridge and hear a bull over here, a bull over here, a bull over here. And it's almost like they're just telling each other where they're at. So basically, right. I'm just trying to sound like I'm trying to tell somebody where I'm at, you know, and then when they answer, then that's the giveaway. So at that point, I'll cut as much ground as possible, try and get in that magic circle of, you know, 150 yards and see what's going on, you know, maybe bugle one more time and see if he answers again. And then the whole thought behind calling elk when you get into that circle for me is I like to be telling them that I'm a bull about to steal your cows, and that, that draws their attention. So, you know, obviously want some terrain in between you or, you know, some sort of structure, and I'll bugle and then I'll get a little bit closer and I'll cow call. And typically they seem to think that, somebody's about to steal these cows from me. So that's typically where the fighting starts. And then you can always hear it in their voice. You know, once they start getting that squeal and the pissed off sound, then I'll stay with a bugle. And a lot of times, I mean, not every time, but a lot of times they come really aggressive. Like I'm not, you know, they're not thinking straight at that point other than I'm going to kick somebody's ass.
Right. So,
and, you know, and if that doesn't work, it's so there's the other part of my calling right there. I never try to sound bigger than they are. I mean, competition bugling is awesome. I love to hear, you know, Corey Jacobson and Jason Phelps and so many good callers in social media now. But those are typically the calls that I'm not going to make when I'm in that 100 yards, 150 yards. I'm going to make a sound that says I'm smaller than you, but I'm still going to try and steal your cow. And that seems to really work a lot. And actually in the video that we did, I'm just using a reed. I use the Phelps amp frame calls. I love them to death. And the tube.
Yeah, so do I.
And the tube is with my brother that's about 300 yards back down the hill because he didn't realize that the first bull boogered on us and he took off. And I thought, well, we'll just keep going. Well, we didn't have cell service. We didn't have radios or anything. We're in big country. I told the cameraman and Jesse, I said, let's just keep going up here. And so I ended up calling in the second bull with just the reed bugling with my hand cupped, you know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so there's a few sequences on the video that you'll watch. It doesn't sound that great because it's not through a tube. And so that's where I'm distinguishing the difference between a competition call and a call that's going to make it happen, you know. And that bull,
yeah.
I mean, he came into 44 yards and that was good enough. So
it's funny that you say that because I actually did a video. I can't remember if it was before I went to Washington or after I went to Washington about bugling and sounding like a beatable bull. And at the time, this was before anybody was, coming out and saying, you know, bull calling cows bugles or, you know, any, you know, naming them. And for the longest time, that's what I would do. I would do that sound. I would, you know, I thought I was just sounding like a pussy bull. Mm-hmm. And I would use just a little piece of pool hose, just enough to give me a throaty sound, but by no means, you know, sound like a big bull. So I just sound like a small satellite bull. You know,
sure.
Like you said, I got short man's disease and I'm going to come and steal your cow, you know, even though I know I'm a little guy, you know, and it seemed to work for me. I did it here in Arizona and I did it when I was in Washington. And I was able to create a, you know, bunch of opportunities. I never ended up killing one. Mainly, I'll tell you the story. I'm sure I've told it on the podcast several times. Of, I had a bull the very first night at 30 yards. And he was just, to me, it was a little raghorn. And I didn't know any better that, you know, you shoot something like that in Washington when it's a Roosevelt, you know. And I let him go, got back to camp that night. We showed everybody the video. I'm like, yeah, I drew back on this bull. Look at, you know, and everybody's like, what? You let that go? And I was like, oh, well, we don't shoot 220-inch bulls, you know, in Arizona. I don't know what to tell you, man. It's like, I didn't know. Now that I know, of course. And then I had another opportunity on a decent 5x5 that probably would have been right around that 250-ish to 260 range. And he just never gave me a good look. And I mean, I'm telling you what, you put me in that situation today, I'm shooting all day long.
Yeah.
Back then, I hadn't killed a bunch of bulls. I think at that point I only had killed one. We're talking, yeah, one or two. Because I wasn't traveling out of state for elk hunting at that point. That was only my second time out of state, and we're talking about 12 years ago at least. So I had to rely on drawn tags here in Arizona, and I only had drawn one tag at that point. For bulls, I had killed three cows already, but, anyhow, so, you know, I didn't have the confidence that if I shot at that angle and that big of an animal that I would be able to take it down. Now, like, you know, now I've killed them in a couple of different situations that were very similar to that one that I was in. And I would definitely take that shot now.
Yeah.
That, you know, equipment's gotten a lot better since then too, but.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the thing about hunting Rosies and versus what you see is Rocky Mountain elk. I mean, most people that come from out of state to hunt here, they don't really understand that 220 type of bull is a super, super nice bull for a Washington Roosevelt.
Yeah. And I had zero clue. Yeah. Zero clue.
It's kind of like me going mule deer hunting over in Montana or Wyoming. The first time that I ever went, I'd seen a 4-point mule deer buck, and I was telling my buddy, I'm shooting that buck. He's like, no, you're not. And I said, are you kidding me? I've never passed a 4-point buck up in my life. And I said, my dad would kill me if he knew I didn't shoot a 4-point buck. And then he talked me out of shooting it. And then heck, it worked.
Those 120s and 130s get you when you go out of places. You're looking at blacktail your whole life, and 120 is like a giant.
Yeah. So, but anyway, I ended up shooting another one, and he told me, he swore, he says, I'm telling you, he says, it's spindly, don't shoot it. And I'm like, you're out of your mind. I'm shooting it. And I shot it, and, you know, of course it was November, and its neck's all blowed up and made it look just massive, and I get over there and he was exactly right, but I was damn proud of my first 4-point mule deer, I'll tell you that.
Yeah that's crazy. So I think, did we get through everything you'd like to do with calling? Because I think I cut you off.
No, that's okay. No, I could talk calling all day long, John. It's so fun. I mean,
so yeah, you were talking to us about sounding like a beatable bull, and I want to get back into where you were at over there. So you were using just your mouth when you were calling this one bull.
Yeah. And, yep.
Or just your hands and the mouth read.
Yeah. And so the interesting part of that story is, I mean, this was the first day, and my son finally got to go to elk camp with us. He had graduated. He was all in school September 1st, so I wasn't going to be picky, but the first bull that came in was probably anywhere between 330 and 350. I mean, he was so good. Wow. And it was September 1st. They weren't really super hot yet, but he'd bugled, I don't know, 25 times, and finally cat and mouse long enough where I started to put the pressure on him, and ended up smelling us, and he took off. Well, The smaller bull that I ended up killing was the one that was way more aggressive, because I think he thought that I was more in his game, you know, with that sound, like, well, I got this guy. He don't sound very big. So mm-hmm. he ended up coming right in, and I ended up harvesting that bull. But definitely the sounds. I mean, I called several times cow calling, and it seemed mm-hmm. like they answered the bugle way more than that cow call. So I just stuck with that bugle. And in the final countdown, the last time I bugled, he was probably within 80 yards, and he cut the distance to 44 in just a couple of seconds and a whack.
Wow. Nice. Yeah. That's awesome.
So,
if you can describe to me the perfect situation, like, where you know if you have this kind of terrain, you know, this kind of weather, this kind of wind, and the bull is doing this. Give me all the situations where you know if you got those things, you think in your head, dead bull.
If I'm hunting some open country right at daylight, I'm thinking one of those cold September mornings, frost mm-hmm. on the ground, a bull's bugling, and I'm watching him from a distance push his cows into a timber patch. That's okay. The first thing that's the most inviting to me. I'm going to figure out, I got time now that he's pushed him into a timber patch. And then there's some structure to be able to get in there and call him in once I get the wind right. And basically, just watching the bull's demeanor, you know, if he looks feisty, if he looks lazy, if he's just walking him into the timber, he's just pushing him into the timber. Mm-hmm. There's things that get me more excited when I think this is a hot bull or it's not a hot bull. But as far as
real quick, I want you to clarify what you're considering a hot bull and what are you looking for that says this is a hot bull.
I'm looking for as far as a hot bull, I'm looking at a bull that just continuously bugles and runs as cows, you know, running into mm-hmm. a corner here, bugling, running back into corner, bugling here, and a bull that'll answer my calls immediately. And sure. I won't be afraid to call three or four times from a distance if I'm not afraid that I'm going to blow him out of there, just to see how he responds. So if he doesn't respond, you know, if he responds maybe one to every three or four calls of mine, I'll think at the time he's not super hot, but we'll see. We're still going to go after him. And then mm-hmm. if he answers, you know, when you get in that timber and he answers, you know, within 100 yards and hits your call right away, that's a hot bull to me. Another characteristic is watching them hook trees, you know, rubbing trees. We call mm-hmm. them hooking trees over here just because they're, you know, they're taking their antler and they're hooking them up the trees. So that's another dead giveaway to me. When I watch them tear the hell out of a alder, you know, or a cedar or whatever it's going to be, that tells mm-hmm. me this guy's, he's ready, you know. And of course, they got mud and dirt and shit on their side too. They've been in a wallow. I mean, those are some dead giveaways for a hot bull for me. So,
yeah, for sure. He's usually when they're hooking trees, they're displaying for a hot cow. So that usually means they're ready to go. Yeah.
And you know, and then, so there's the instant right there for me. I cut the distance, or we cut the distance. I'll try a couple of soft cow calls first. I'll be that lost cow trying to come back into the herd and just see how he responds. Cause sometimes I've seen him do it before where, you know, even if they went into that timber to bed, they'll get out of their bed and they'll start walking over there, you know, figure out what's going on with that cow. Or they'll bugle a couple of times to let that cow know, well, you need to come over here cause this is where the party's at. But, mm-hmm. you know, if there's all of a sudden a stalemate and he's not willing to leave those, you know, 10, 15 cows, then I'll bugle. And then typically that's when it all goes down. But I mean, a lot of times it doesn't either. This coastal wind is brutal. It'll switch. Of course, the thermals in the mountains are bad too. You know that. I mean, a lot of times your window to harvest a bull, you know, when you're in the timber with them is 5 to 10 minutes, sometimes not even that long. I mean, it'll switch, and then you're kind of screwed. I mean, it happens to every one of us.
That's for sure.
But yeah, the perfect scenario for me with that one, John, is that bull comes in. I want him less than 40 yards broadside. That's how I want my, you know, perfect scenario to end. And typically top pin's the best. I've shot him at 8 yards before, and that is that's number one, man.
I bet.
That's the epicness of elk hunting right there.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. So I want to talk a little bit about your number one. You got the state record, right?
The state record for a true archery Roosevelt. And it's actually distinguished in Washington by everything west of I-5, which runs through the middle of the state. So typically everything on the east side, they classify as a Cascade Roosevelt, which could potentially have bred with a Rocky Mountain elk from the Crest Trail. And, you know, there's a lot of pros and cons of that whole thing. But, you know, because the Roosevelts on the other side of I-5 still look like the same as the ones on the west side of I-5. But anyway, I like to call that my favorite mistake bull.
Nice.
But
well, what's your story?
So the rundown on that one, I was actually calling that bull in for my brother, and this bull had probably 25 cows with him in huge timber, and the lower half of this timber was all vineys, and which vine maples is what we call them. But this bull had bugled several times, and he had that bugle that said he was a giant. I mean, to me, the first time I heard him, there was no doubt in my mind. And I've been fooled a lot by bulls that have bugled by their sound. And went, oh, that bull sounds good. You know, and he ends up being a 3-year-old. But this bull, he had it all. So I got my brother all set up, and I started calling this bull. And I don't have an arrow knocked or nothing. Just calling. And he's about 40 yards from me. Well, this bull sounded like he was on the backside of the herd. And so the way we were trying to pull him was going to be a broadside for my brother to take the shot. Well, how he got from one end of the herd to the other in a matter of, I don't know, 40 seconds quietly, he comes straight down the hill towards the call instead of broadside to where I thought my brother was going to whack him. And all I could see was coffee can bases and a giant rack and a huge body. And I trying to dump the bugle, trying to get an arrow out. And because I wasn't expecting him for me. I mean, and heck, by the time I, you know, got an arrow out and tried shoving it in my bow, he turned around and went the other way, seen me. And the gig was over, but I'd actually drawn back and tried to stop him going through all that stuff. And I was trying to stop him, and heck, he wouldn't stop. And I go to let down, and my arrow's not even in my rest. I was so excited when I seen how heavy he was. Well, long story short, he takes off, and me and my brother hook back up, and he's spooked bad. So we talked about it, and I said, let's give him a couple hours and then we'll go back after him. You know, let him go up there and simmer down, big, steep country. And he says, how big was he? And I looked at him and I said, I looked destiny in the eye. I said, that was the biggest bull that I'd ever seen on the hoof. Have you biggest Roosevelt? And I said, he was easily 300, you know, easily, no doubt.
Yeah.
So we went back to the truck, got some water, figured out our next plan of attack, and we went straight uphill for I don't know, quite a while. Stopped, took breaks here and there, and my brother spots him hooking a tree. And so now we can see him at about 90 yards in the old growth, 90 to 100 yards. I mean, he's out of range, but he's sitting there hooking a tree, and he's uphill. Now, the hardest part about calling elk downhill is they're always they've always got the upper hand. So this is going to be it's going to be a tough situation, but we got to make the best of it. We've already burned him out once. So my brother tried to cut into this little saddle with some ferns so we could get a little bit of a structure, you know, maybe to bring him down into, you know, to get that shot. And we talked about it, saying, well, just wait till he starts hooking that tree again so he's busy, and then try and cut the distance. Well, he started to try and make his way into this little spot to where I could potentially pull him down, and that bull saw him. And so now the bull's on full alert. All of his cows are above him. And I'm like, this, I don't know what we're going to do now. Well, the trees are so big up there. My brother's just kind of hunkered down for, I don't know, 2 or 3 minutes goes by. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, it's now or never. And this is where I have this term I call just elk it. And this is, I wrote a song about it. I mean, this is stuff that, from this point right here, instinct to me kicked in. It's a done deal for him. He's pegged. I've got a bunch of big trees that I can maneuver on this bull and stay behind him and get into range. I mean, I only had to cut 40 yards. So I just put a big tree between me and that bull while he was watching my brother. And I mean, this is real elk hunting right here. It don't always work with calling them in, but you got to figure out ways to improvise if you want to harvest them, you know. And I just kept a big tree in between me and him and went as quick as I could behind that tree. And I got to where it was 47 yards. I peeked around the tree, and I, no kidding, I clicked my range finder to range him, and his eyes immediately went to the click of my range finder. No joke. And he's looking at me. So I pull an arrow out. I draw back behind the tree so he can't see me. Like I said, I mean, the old growth is so big, you know, they're 6 to 8 foot, you know, through to where you could actually draw behind them no problem and then lean out. And that is exactly what I did. I knew the range. I pulled back and I leaned out there, and he looked at me. He just didn't know what I was. And he looked just long enough to heart shoot him. It was the best shot I've ever made on a bull that size, 47 yards, heart shot. And I'm telling you, I could have missed my spot by 8 inches, but the good Lord was with me, man. It buried him in the heart, and that bull went 20 yards, and he was dead within about 4 minutes. And then the celebration went. But the thing about hunting with my brother, I always talk a lot about camaraderie. I've called in a lot of bulls for him. He's called in a lot for me, and he wasn't disappointed one iota for that thing. He knew that he was screwed, and he was just thankful that I potentially used my elk instincts. Like I said, just elk it to me is use every elk instinct that you have. It's a make or break when a bull has you pegged. You're down to minimal minutes or seconds. So I went like a bear. Yeah. And anyway, so the favorite mistake part of that was the year before I killed a 349 bull, a Rocky, and it was the first head mounted bull that I had. So I went up on this bull and I'm looking at it, and the body's so big on it, I'm thinking he's 310 to 325. And, and I'm like, oh, my wife's going to crap if I bring home another head mounter, you know, another $1,500 payment. Well, anyway, my brother's like, no, dude, he's bigger than that. You got to mount this thing. And I'm like, no way. I can't. I said, I'll just do a nice Euro mount. And he tried talking me out of it. But the second I cut the head off that bull to start quartering him, he grew a lot. Yeah. He took him away from that body. All of a sudden, he's pushing 350, 349. Yeah. So there you go.
So you got two 349s at the house.
Yeah. And he deducted a little bit the, as far as making the state record, he was, the old one was 343 and some change. And he netted 345 and an eighth, I believe. So he's almost perfect. He only deducted about four and some change. But, yeah, wow. I mean, you know, this, yeah, I could talk elk hunting forever, man. It's the greatest thing in the world besides a family.
Yeah, absolutely. I love elk hunting. I love all hunting. I it's funny, whatever season it is, that's how excited I am about that. I mean, I always get excited about elk now because not that it's really the first thing I hunt because I always hunt deer before, you know, high country muleys and or coos deer here in August and late July. I'll hunt blacktail in California. So I do hunt deer before elk, but for some reason, it's always the first season in my head that I'm excited about coming up. Cause I really don't, I like hunting velvet deer, but I get excited about deer during the rut. Like that's when I get excited about it. Yeah. Especially here, Maisie. I love hunting the desert and desert bucks in the rut. Super fun. That's awesome, man. So, do you have another story that, I don't know, could be outrageous story? Just one that you had a teaching moment, whatever. Just share another story.
I got an outrageous cougar hunt story. If I can go ahead and throw that into elk hunting. Okay. 2 years ago, I ended up calling a cougar in. I got shingles, that thing that like chicken pox that goes up your side and up your back and everything. Mm-hmm. And it was miserable. Mm-hmm. And it was in January. And so I had to take some time off of work. And I had 40 some pictures of this cat on my trail camera. And I thought, well, hell, I'm going to throw my rifle in and camo up and see if I can't go call that cat in, you know. And it took me a couple different times, right. But just me and this cougar that was, I think he was about 8'6". 170 some pounds. He's a hooter tom. We're on the ground floor together at 18 yards, and that thing never made a sound. And all I could see was the white on its muzzle. And I clicked my safety off. I shoot a Ruger 270 for my rifle, and I clicked my safety off. And no joke, that cat heard me click the safety off, and it went with the raspiest, screaminest sound I ever heard. I mean, it curled the hair on my back, no doubt. And I ended up popping him at 18 yards. And I shot him twice really fast because I thought, holy shit, I'm going to walk up on this thing. His paws are as big as my face. And neither one of those bullets exited that cat at 18 yards. They're just solid muscle. I mean, you living in Arizona, you probably know a lot about cats, but I didn't know nothing.
Yeah, but we don't grow them that big over here. No, our cats are sprinters. You know, they usually have to run a bunch. They got lungs on them here, but they don't grow very big because they're because of the habitat. You know, and I'd say, you know, like a big tom here is probably like 100, like. If you got a 150-pound cat, you're doing something special. So, yeah, I shot one that was like 118, 120-ish. And it was 9 years old.
Wow. Yeah,
so it wasn't a young cat.
Huh.
That's
different. And you have – now their main food source over there is probably deer.
They do take it. They take down elk also. Definitely the cats that are up in the Ponderosa country or the high country stuff are definitely larger, as are the deer. So like, for instance, if you hunt coos bucks down south by the border or in the desert, you know, big coos buck during the rut will be like 100, like a really big one, be like 130 pounds. And you hunt that same buck up like up on the Mogollon Rim or, you know, up by Flagstaff or something like that, it'll be 20 pounds heavier. So sometimes more. I've heard them go. I've never seen one that big, but I've heard them go, you know, just closer to that 170 range, which was,
That's actually a pretty common one here in Washington for that size. I mean, there's toms every year harvested between 140 and 200. I don't know why. I guess maybe it's because maybe it's our deer and our elk are fatter or something. I don't know.
Well, I think that's just what it is, man. I kind of mentioned the lungs thing. Like our cats, when they hunt, they typically gotta, you know, I like to call it cheetah them down. You know, they have to run things down, where I think over there it's more of an ambush thing.
And, yeah.
You know, they're just, not that cats don't do that here too. I'm sure, you know, I've watched it, but it's usually a chase, you know, and I just think it just lends itself to a higher success for them if they're nimble and fast. And
that makes a lot of sense. Absolutely. So, I would totally agree.
That's just my two cents.
Just hold me on it. I agree with that.
I sound like I know what I'm talking about. Oh, cool, man. Well, awesome. So real quick, before I let you go, tell us a little bit about your music and where people could find out about.
Yeah. So I'm on iTunes, Tony Winthrop iTunes. I have an album called Bull Down, which, it's been the main stem for my music into the outdoor industry. I've opened for Charlie Daniels and Clint Black and Dierks Bentley and a few other people. So that part of my music career really got me going. But the genre with the outdoor stuff, basically bulldownproductions.com is where you can pick up the CDs, a couple different albums, and then iTunes and CD Baby also. And I'm at Elk Singer for Instagram, cool. And then Facebook just under Tony Winthrop.
Awesome, man. Well, I want to thank you for coming on and sharing your stories with us and talking about elk. I'm going to be my plan is to be in Oregon. I'm going to go to Oregon and hunt Rosies with Shannon Mobbs and Corey Ford.
Good
from Angry Spike. Yeah, love those guys. Those are good to hunt with, fun to hang out with. So, we're hopefully I'll get a chance to meet up with you one of these days and go elk hunting up there, maybe.
Absolutely.
I've never been to Washington and not got pounded with rain. So I have a little bit of disdain for Washington, but I definitely like to give it a go here. I gotta get a rose. I still haven't killed a Rosie yet. So I've only gone twice now. So it's not, like I put a bunch of, effort into it yet, but hopefully this year, now that I got it, kind of dialed in and I've had some good mentors with the ASP guys. So, We'll see. Maybe I'll be able to.
Yeah,
make it
those guys
this
are
year.
Great hunters. I mean, they're stone cold killers. You're going with the right guys for Roosevelt's for sure.
Oh yeah, that's for sure. All right, man. Well, I will talk to you soon. Thanks for coming on, and I hope.
Yes,
you
too. Thanks, brother. So glad to meet you, and thank you again for having me on your show.
Hey guys, want to stay connected with the podcast? Check out my blog. johnstallone.me. That's www.johnstallone.me. And you could go on there. On the top right-hand corner, there's a little subscribe box. Quickly put in an email address, hit subscribe, and boom, you're done. There's a lot of great information on there. A lot of posts that go hand-in-hand with the podcasts that we do, plus gear reviews. Plus we have the signature t-shirts on there, the I Eat Fast Food t-shirts, and the Tuesday Coosday shirts. It's a really good way to stay connected with the podcast. And thanks for listening.